The date was July 26, 2004. The place was my in-law's backyard. And Jess and I, on that morning, early that morning, we had flown away from Winnipeg. We had left our children. We were on our first leg of our trip to Kenya, a missions trip, a month-long missions trip. But on that very day, the reason I'm highlighting the backyard is because the rest of the family was having Solomon's third birthday party. It was his third birthday. And on that day, they were all having fun in a pool party. The whole family was there. They were enjoying the day. And as Solomon, being 3 years old, was doing what any three-year-old would do, he's running around the pool. He'd been swimming for a little bit. He'd gotten out of the pool, probably eating some sort of snack or something like that. And as he's running around the pool, something that's not terribly unexpected, he couldn't swim. But there were five adults at least present at this party, and he did one of these off the edge and into the pool. Well, Carolyn, on one occasion, jumped into the pool to save him. She overjumped and ended up in the middle of the pool. And by the time she actually got to where Solomon was, Clayton had already reached down from the edge of the pool and pulled him out of the water. Kind of like that. Reaching down and just grabbing him. Now, Solomon was completely unaware of what was going on because it didn't happen just once, but twice. You know, some kids take a little bit longer to learn, but that's okay. The whole point of this story is simply that Solomon had complete and utter trust in those he was with, that even if he fell in, it didn't matter to him. He didn't know how to swim. He didn't understand the dangers. He didn't care. It's his third birthday. He's just having fun. And I believe eventually they put a life jacket on the poor kid so that if he did fall in, he would just float around in the pool by himself. And that was fine. But it's a lesson for all of us as believers that we must trust in the providence of God, even when you can't feel the presence of God. And I believe this is a foundational thing for us to understand. And Paul had found himself in a ton of conflict in our passage. If you recall, he is in so much trouble at this point. He was in trouble because there were Jews planning to, they hated him. In fact, he was brought before them, and if you recall, he mentions the resurrection, and suddenly a fight breaks out amongst them to the point where the Romans have to haul him off back to jail for his own safety. And today we're going to see that as a result of that, some Jews, they decide they're planning an ambush, and they want to assassinate him. But through it all, Paul kept a good conscience. He was comforted by the Lord. And that's all he needed, was the Lord. And before we get to the rest of Acts chapter 23, I want to circle back to verse 11, which we covered last week. And in verse 11, it says this: "The following night, the Lord stood near Paul and said, 'Take courage. As you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome.'" And by my count, this is the fourth time in the book of Acts that the Lord has appeared to Paul to encourage him. And when Paul was struggling, when he was feeling overwhelmed, the Lord himself stood by him. And the Lord promises his presence to comfort us when we are going through problems. And near the end of Paul's life, he wrote these words from prison in 2 Timothy chapter 4, but the Lord stood by me and strengthened me. Those words speak to me, and I hope they speak to you. The Lord of heaven and of earth made a personal visit to Paul to encourage him to keep going. Paul was commended for testifying about Christ in Jerusalem, and he was commissioned to do the same thing in Rome. You're going to get to Rome and you're going to testify for me. You're going to testify about me. You're going to share with Rome who I am. Not who Paul is, but who Jesus is. And that is an amazing thing. These words of comfort and commendation and commission give Paul the courage to press on. And he's going to need to remember that because, ironically, things are about to get worse. They're about to get even dicier for him. God is always at work, though, and even when we can't see him, God is at work. And when things are confusing, when things are chaotic, his presence should give you comfort. So if you're in that type of season of your life right now where things are chaotic, things are confusing, know that God's presence is with you. Now in verse 14, it appears that Paul was outnumbered by his enemies and they were wanting to assassinate him. And even though he had received the promise to testify about the gospel in Rome, it looked bleak. And I imagine him thinking to himself, but Lord, I thought you said, aren't you gonna... But no one was there. No one came to his rescue, at least not right away, and certainly not in the way that he expected. And our text is a fascinating and interesting text, at least from a pastoral point of view. I hope you can see it as well, because in this passage, I don't see any commands from the Lord. I don't see even a mention of God at all. We see no miracles. We see no message from the Lord. We see no believers praying. We see no explanation of the salvation or gospel message. We don't see any of that. But what we do see is an amazing illustration of the doctrine of God's providence. And the easiest way to remember what God's providence is and what it means is to focus on the root of the word, which is to provide. Providence is the presence of and the governing of all things under the intentional sovereign rule of God. And here's one definition that I found. Divine providence is the governance of God by which he, with wisdom and love, cares for and directs all things in the universe. There's nothing outside of the scope of the entire universe that God is not aware of and directing. Nothing. And here's what I'm hoping we come away with today. That we trust in the providence of God when you can't feel the presence of God. And I know that not feeling the presence of God happens. It happens a lot. But even when we can't feel his presence, we trust in his providence. And today I see that there's at least four ways that our trust, four ways for our trust to increase. And the first is to recognize the plot against you. Check this out in verse 12. The next morning, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves with an oath not to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. More than 40 men were involved in this plot. They went to the chief priests and the elders, and they said, "We have taken a solemn oath not to eat anything until we have killed Paul. Now then, you and the Sanhedrin, petition the commander and bring him before you on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about his case. And we are ready to kill him before he gets here." Let's talk about conspiracies for a moment. 40 men, grand conspiracy. What in the world is going on here? These Jews would certainly have known the sixth commandment. Do you guys remember the sixth commandment? Number six, don't murder people. Do not kill. They knew the sixth commandment, but they were filled with such hatred and rage and a need for revenge that they somehow justified their murderous scheme. And Jesus predicted that this would happen. Jesus said in John chapter 16, "Indeed, the hour is coming when whoever kills you will think he is offering service to God." There are so many things wrong in this short section of Scripture. Paul is literally living in a conspiracy, and this is no theory. This is reality. These religious radicals were so determined to kill Paul that they placed themselves under a curse if they did not fulfill it. So they want to kill Paul, and they're encouraging others to be a part of this plan, including the religious leaders. And they were willing to die for a sinful cause. They were willing to spend eternity under the curse of God if Paul was allowed to live. Do you understand what they're saying? Like, this is absolute nuts. And just like Judas, these 40 fanatical men realized that they needed the help of the religious leadership. They needed their help to accomplish their assassination plans. And so they urged these religious leaders to ask the Roman officials to bring Paul down to them under false pretenses so that they can ambush him on the way and kill him. Now, one would think that these religious leaders would shut this down. "You're planning on murdering someone?" Absolutely not. But no, they agree to this plot. Folks, I'm going to be honest with you right here, right now. If you come to me and say, "Dave, I need you to help out with this plot. I'm going to kill someone." I am going to look at you and say, "Absolutely not. Who do you want to kill? Thank you. 911. Hello." "I will call the police on you." But Paul is living in a whole different world where apparently this is just commonplace. Are you aware that there is a plot against you? Did you know that? That the Christian life is not a playground, it is a battleground? Are you aware of the fact that we must be on our guard at all times because we have at least three enemies stalking us incessantly? The first enemy that we have that is stalking us is our own flesh. From within us. Our own flesh is sinful. Our own flesh wants to be at war with us. And the second one is the world around us. The world around us doesn't want us to succeed as Christians. Our morals seem crazy to them. And they do all sorts of things to drag us down. And the third one is the devil himself and all of his demons are plotting our demise. 1 Peter chapter 2 says that our passions and our flesh wage war against our soul. It's like we're in an internal civil war between our flesh and our spirit. And the world around us, we are faced with so many outside influences, so many temptations. We're faced with all of this stuff. And 1 John chapter 2 talks about how within us the world and our love of worldly things is not from God. And according to 1 Peter chapter 5, we are being targeted by the devil and his demons who want to ambush us, to devour us. His strategy is to trip us up and to bring us down. And ironically, Christians are often criticized about being intolerant by the very groups who claim to be tolerant of everyone except us. So we need to trust in the providence of God, even when you can't feel the presence of God. And a second way to increase our trust is to rely upon the provisions of God and what God is providing for you. You see, this plot against Paul seemed like a pretty good plan. 40 hangry men. Yes, I said hangry. They vowed not to eat or drink. They're hangry. They're hangry men who could easily surround and kill one prisoner. How hard could that possibly be? And by all accounts, Paul should be dead before the sun comes up. And against overwhelming odds, God providentially provided a way for Paul by positioning Paul's nephew to hear about this plot. Check this out. This is awesome. Verse 16. But when the son of Paul's sister heard of this plot, he went into the barracks and told Paul. Now, up to this point, we've not heard anything about Paul's family members. But since God is in control, he positions this young man in the exact place at the precise time to hear about the plans of this ambush. And then he goes and talks to his uncle. Right? And we're not given his nephew's name. We're not given any background information about this young man. This is just another example of how God loves to use an ordinary person to accomplish his purposes. In fact, we don't know if this nephew of his is even a believer or if he's just simply concerned for his uncle. I hope that if you heard about a plot against your relative that you would say something. Or if you hear something about someone else, that you would go to them and say, hey, look, I've heard this. And this young man took a risk by entering into the barracks to tell Paul about the plot. In verse 17, it says, then Paul called one of the centurions and said, take this young man to the commander. He has something to tell him. So he took him to the commander. And the centurion said, Paul, the prisoner sent for me and asked me to bring this young man to you because he has something to tell you. The commander took the young man by the hand and drew him aside and asked, what is it you want to tell me? He said, the Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul before the Sanhedrin tomorrow on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about him. Don't give in to them, because more than 40 of them are waiting in ambush for him. They have taken an oath not to eat or drink until they have killed him. They are ready now, waiting for your consent to their request. The commander dismissed the young man and cautioned him, "Don't tell anyone that you have reported this to me." Wow. Isn't this amazing? When Paul heard about this plot, he boldly called one of the centurions over. Remember, he's a prisoner. He doesn't just call one of the soldiers. He calls a centurion over. He gets one of the commanders and says to him, directly to him, "You need to take this boy, my nephew, to the Roman officer, to the warden, to the guy in charge of all of this." And this officer does it. He knows nothing about what is about to be said. "Take this young boy to the commander at once." I don't know about you, but I'm not really familiar with prisons, but I don't think that's how it works. "Guard, come here. I demand that you take my visitor to see the warden immediately." "Oh, okay, sure. Come on." I don't think that's how prison typically works, but that's how it worked for Paul. And they took him tenderly, the commander takes him tenderly by the hand and talk to him privately to get the details of whatever this message is. And before dismissing the young man, he told him, "Don't talk about this plot," so that he could put together a plan. And we see God providentially at work in how Paul was able to be so direct with the centurion. And that with his seasoned leader in charge of all this, listening to him. And even more amazingly, that the Roman tribune, the man in charge of it all, took the time to hear what Paul's nephew had to say. Didn't just go, "I don't care, send him away." He takes the time to do it. And not only does he listen to him, he takes it seriously. Now, some might say that this is luck. But there is no luck with God. Only what I call divinely prompted coincidences. Okay, divinely prompted incidences. There's no coincidence. It's just the providence of God. Trust in the providence of God when you can't feel his presence. And you can do that by recognizing the plot against you, by relying on the provisions that God has for you. And that leads us to the third way to increase your trust. Rest in the protection of God. Especially when your circumstances look bleak, God is providentially at work for his glory and your good. Check out verse 23. When he called two of his centurions and ordered them, "Get ready a detachment of 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at 9 o'clock tonight. Provide mounts for Paul so that he may be taken safely to Governor Felix." This military leader quickly organizes a highly trained security detail of 472 men to escort Paul out of the city. And this group consists of 200 heavily armed soldiers, 70 members of the cavalry, and 200 spearmen or javelin throwers, plus the two centurions. That is phenomenal. In God's sweet providence, Paul was even given a mount to ride, which again shows God's providence. If they thought Paul was really a criminal, at best they would have made him walk. But not this case. What is really cool is that he had not just one mount, but did you see it's plural? Give him a few horses just in case his gets tired. Mounts, plural. And they left at 9 p.m. because they didn't want to travel, or because they wanted to travel under the cover of darkness. To leave before these 40 fasting men would expect them to. And Paul rode out, escorted like an emperor, not a prisoner. It's awesome how God often goes over and above in how he provides. And this is a wonderful illustration of Ephesians 3:20. Now to him who is able to do far more abundantly than all that we ask or think, according to his power and work within us. Now to the average person, they would look at the fortress of Antonia and they would see 470-ish, almost 500 men. And they would see them all leaving and they would just be thinking to themselves, battalion relocation. Because they didn't put Paul on the outside or the front. They most likely put him in the middle and he's just one of the people. Now to the Jews who are looking at this from an assassination point of view, seeing roughly 500 soldiers leaving, man, this is awesome. They just half the number of soldiers here. This is great. But after organizing Paul's protective detail, the military officer wrote a letter to Governor Felix explaining the situation. And yet, as we read this letter, we're going to realize that he got most of the details maybe right, kind of. Well, at least they were right in his mind. He did gloss over his own mistakes quite a bit while making himself look like a hero. Sounds pretty typical, doesn't it? So let's check out this letter. He wrote a letter as follows. Claudius Lysias, to His Excellency Governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews, and they were about to kill him, but I came with my troops and rescued him, for I had learned that he was a Roman citizen. I wanted to know why they were accusing him, so I brought him to their Sanhedrin. I found out that the accusation had to do with questions about their law, but there was no charge against him that deserved death or imprisonment. When I was informed of a plot to be carried out against the man, I sent him to you at once. I also ordered his accusers to present to you their case against him. Now, do you notice he didn't mention that he almost had Paul scourged? And it's significant that he declared Paul had done nothing deserving death or imprisonment. Yet, he still could not let him go. He also jumbled the facts quite a bit. It almost sounds like he knew Paul was a Roman citizen And that is the reason why he put a stop to these proceedings. But that isn't exactly accurate, is it? He didn't know that about Paul until quite well into the whole incident. But he sends this letter, making himself look good, as a letter of protection for Paul. So what happens next? So the soldiers, carrying out their orders, took Paul with them during the night and brought him as far as Antipatris. And the next day, they let the cavalry go on with him while they returned to the barracks. Now, Antipatris is located about 40 miles north of Jerusalem. It was the site of a huge Roman garrison. And believing Paul to be safe there, they decided to spend the night. And the soldiers and the javelin men or spearmen, they returned to Jerusalem, leaving 70 horsemen to continue on with him to Caesarea the next day. We need to trust in the providence of God when we can't feel the presence of God. We need to recognize that there is a plot against us. We need to rely upon the provisions of God. We need to rest in the protection of God around us. And then there's one more way to trust his providence. Rejoice. Rejoice in the purpose of God for you. Our purpose in life should be to live out God's purposes for us. Now check out this last little bit of our passage. When the cavalry arrived in Caesarea, they delivered the letter to the governor and handed Paul over to him. The governor read the letter and asked what province he was from. Learning that he was from Sicilia, he said, "I will hear your case when your accusers get here." Then he ordered that Paul be kept under guard in Herod's palace. That's awesome. Caesarea, 26 miles from Antipas, and they get there. It's essentially was a preliminary hearing to determine where Paul's case would be tried and who should hear it. Now, Herod the Great had built an amazing praetorium. Beautiful beachfront property. And Paul's lodging was in this place. It was more like a luxury apartment than a prison. But Paul's imprisonment was actually God's providential protection for Paul. It put him in a position to share the gospel with two Roman governors. Plus, it put him on the path to accomplish his larger purpose of taking the gospel to Rome. With Roman protection. How awesome is that? Folks, if you don't understand anything, understand this. God is an amazing God. And when he has a job and a purpose, that will come to fruition. It will happen. It may not happen the way we want things to happen, but God's purposes will get done in his time. And so, he wants us to live out his purposes for his glory. And we may not see 470 soldiers at our side, but you can be assured until you finish your work, God will protect you and allow you to rejoice in his purposes. God loves to take what is bad and turn it into good, all for his glory. Not everything's going to be a five-star event, We're not all going to get to stay in the palace of Herod. Remember that Paul was nearly killed before he was protected, but he was protected. And so I ask you, what about you? Are you ready to increase your trust in the providence of God when you can't feel the presence of God? Can you do that today? Now, before we finish, I've got some real ways that we can apply this passage to our lives. The first is, be prepared to face opposition and trials, which will come when you choose to serve the Lord. Persecution is not a guarantee, but it is promised. But a more positive application is to use your position as a platform for God's purposes. Think back to the book of Esther for a moment. Mordecai was used by God to overhear a plot against the king's life. And God positioned Paul's nephew to hear about a planned ambush against his life. Or against his uncle's life, actually. And later, Esther needed to be reminded by Mordecai how God wanted to use her position as queen to accomplish his purposes. And in Esther 4:14, it says this, "For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this." Folks, we know the story of Esther. We know how Mordecai was used, how Esther was used to save the people. We see in this story how Paul was used, how his nephew was used, and how Paul is being used to take the gospel to Rome, to take the gospel to the authorities, to two governors. God is at work. And we need to always give God the credit for his providence. So here's a challenge. If you're a person who likes the words coincidence and luck, stop using them. Stop using words like luck or coincidence and give credit to God. Always give credit to God. The world's not going to do that. Worldly people will take credit for themselves or give credit to anything and everything except God. But as a believer, give credit to God and realize that just because God is silent doesn't mean that he's absent. Remember this passage where I said what's cool about it from a pastoral book? God's not even mentioned in any of this. He's not even mentioned at all in our story, but his hand was guiding every single event. He was right there, ready to reach down into that pool of life and to save Paul. God is in charge of all people and in all places. Now, on a side note, I really wonder, what happened to those 40 assassins? I'm fairly certain that if they kept their oath, they starved to death. However, they're men. I don't believe they kept their vow more than a day or two. You see, the religious people plotted against Jesus, and they ultimately had him killed because evil men do evil things. But God providentially arranged all of the details for Jesus to die in our place. His death wasn't an accident, nor did it catch the Father off guard, because it was through the death of his Son that you and I can be forgiven for our sins. And this whole plot against Paul, it didn't catch God off guard. He knew exactly what was in the hearts of these 40 men. And he made arrangements for Paul to be taken away. Because his goal was to get Paul to Rome to preach the gospel there. He had a few stops on the way, and we're going to learn about those over the next several weeks. But everywhere he goes, he preaches the gospel. So today, I ask you, what can you trust in? What about you? Can you put your trust in the providence of God? Can you increase your trust in God today? Even if you can't feel his presence today. And if you can feel his presence today, and you do have that relationship, can you still increase your trust in God? Because God is everything. God is everything in my life. Is God everything in your life? Today, I was worried about today, to be honest. Yesterday, I was given a wonderful gift of being taken to the banjo bowl. Years ago, I vowed I would not go to another Saturday Bomber game. Because I have to preach on Sunday, and my voice doesn't tend to last very long on Sundays. And this morning I taught Sunday school, and after Sunday school, I started to feel it in my voice. And as we sang, I felt my voice getting quieter and more gravelly. And so I admit that I did not sing the last song. I closed my eyes and I prayed. And I said, Lord, let my voice be your voice this morning. Strong and bold as I preach. I'm not sure how much I'm going to talk for the rest of the day. Because I'm feeling it getting even worse. But God in his providence worked through that even. That tiny little thing. Because God is everything in my life. And I want to be used by him. How about you? Are you wanting to be used by him? Are you willing to trust him for even the smallest thing of your voice? Will you let him use you to be his voice, to share what he has been doing in your life with someone else? And so I encourage you today, no matter what's going on sometime this week coming up, can you share with one person what God is doing in your life and how God has been at work in your life? Can you share with one person and let them know how much you love God and how much he means to you? Trust in his providence. You may be thinking, I don't know what to say. Trust God. He'll give you the words. Worship team, will you come and lead us in our closing hour? Because since Jesus came into my heart, everything changed.